Today on the Inland Journal podcast, we turn to the Spokane City Council president race. It features Councilman Brian Beggs and businesswoman Cindy Wendell. Both hope to replace the two-term incumbent Ben Stuckert. We'll go in alphabetical order, so that means today Steve Jackson will interview Beggs, and next time he'll talk with Wendell. Brian Beggs attended Whitworth University and the law school at the University of Washington. He serves as an attorney in private practice, focusing on social justice, once serving as the director of the Center for Justice. He was appointed to the city council in early 2016, then won an election in 2017 to keep his South District seat. If he loses this race, he will still hold that seat. Here's Brian Beggs with Steve Jackson.
That hot button thing this year again is the homeless issue. And maybe just touch on it for a bit about the best strategy for moving ahead. I mean, is the city been doing the right process at this point? Are there things we can do better? What are your thoughts on it?
So the city is doing all the right things, but it's taking too long. Council is waiting. Please, Mayor, give us a contract to open the next warming shelter. Give us a contract for the next service provider. But really, we're addressing it at all levels. So the first thing is we have changed our zoning rules so that we can put more housing and denser housing in our centers and corridors and downtown. So we can simply fit in more people with more units, and that will bring the cost per unit down. Mm-hmm. And it will bring the whole market down in terms of price, so more affordable for everyone, not just homeless people. We understand now the best thing that works is what we call housing first. And that is a low barrier entry to a shelter, a warming center. And you start there, but you don't finish there. You try to move people on to more services, and you hold them more and more personally accountable along the way. And so if they've got a drug problem, they're going to treatment. And if they need to get more education to work, they go to a training program. And as they move through the services, they get more privileges, and they're held to greater accountability. And eventually, we get them into real housing and self-sufficient working for those who can. And if they can't work because they're disabled, we get them on to the federal disability program in a housing situation that meets their needs, and they're not causing trouble for other people. And really, then the other thing is what we're really missing is money from the state to build more housing and for more treatment services. I think there's a myth out there that these people you see downtown who look a little funny, that they could go to treatment, but they just don't want to. And the truth is, there aren't beds for them. They can't go even if they want to. And we're really trying to figure out a multitude of facilities that can gradually move people forward. In fact, just one example is we have people in jail, literally, who the judges would release. They haven't been convicted. They're waiting for their trial. But because they're homeless, the judge won't release them. So we want a 40-bed facility that those people could go there and be out of the weather and ready and available for court and starting treatment. We want shelters available for people who can't afford the rent and need to get back on their feet. We want mental health places to do that.
And maybe I'll just follow up with just a couple of quick questions would be, do you know how much money we're currently spending on that homeless issue? Not the housing issue, but just the homeless issue. And should we spend more, or what are your thoughts on that related to the budget?
So we are spending millions of dollars every year. Almost all that money is state and federal money. The city itself is now spending $1.5 million of our own tax money. A lot of that money goes to keep people in housing. It's cheaper to keep people in housing than to let them become homeless and find new housing. So we have a variety of programs. We need to spend more, though. We're in a little bit of a crisis, I would say, on homelessness. Most people think so. And we've saved our money well and spent it wisely. So we have a reserve that we could spend to really get downtown back to the way it was before the mayor closed half the shelter beds at Catholic Charities. And so we need to spend, I would say, several more million dollars a year locally to do that.
Okay. And you started to talk about the housing crunch, and that's kind of where I'm going to go with the next series of questions. So maybe talk a little bit. You talked about the zoning, but do you want to maybe elaborate more? I mean, what other kinds of ways can we increase not just the low, maybe the low-income housing is one thing, but maybe just the overall options for getting more housing into the community?
Yeah, it's all interrelated. So in the Great Recession 10 years ago, all the housing building stopped for a while. Lots of people went out of the profession and found new jobs. And now we've turned things around in Spokane, and people are moving here by the thousands every year. And there's just not enough housing for them. So they're bidding up the prices. And that means people who could barely afford housing, whether it's to purchase or to rent, can't afford it. And a lot of people, when we survey who's homeless, they simply can't afford the rent. And they're kind of becoming refugees of a rising housing market. And so really, you need to increase the supply in order to lower that price. And again, the government's not going to build a bunch of housing. In Europe, the government builds all the housing for everybody almost. We don't have that system here. But we can change the regulations and make it easier. We can make it easier to put more denser housing, and we can put in tax incentives, which we do. We have the multifamily tax exemptions for people who build multifamily housing downtown in our centers or corridors. And council for the last 2 years has been pulling all those levers and substantially increasing the market availability for builders. And they are now starting to respond, but it's probably going to be another 18 months before we really see a difference. But if we get that figured out, that's going to help everybody, not just low-income people, people working at the lower end of the economy, but first-time home buyers and even mid-level home buyers. As supply goes up, the price will go down for all of us.
Do you like the concept of putting in maybe multifamily dwellings in some of these neighborhoods that have only been, you know, single-family houses until this point?
We have a lot of different zoning packages out there. And so generally, if a neighborhood is zoned totally just single family, you're probably not going to put apartment buildings in there. But what you can do is you can increase the number of small houses or cottages on one lot. So they're still single family in character. They still kind of fit, but you get way more people in there. On the neighborhoods that are zoned multifamily, a lot of them actually have single family housing in there. But everybody knows when you bought your house, it could be multifamily. And what we've done in those neighborhoods is we've increased the height from 2 stories to 3. Again, that's not a huge disruption to go from 2 stories to 3, but it increases the availability by 50%. And we've done a few other tweaks of allowing people to use a little more of the lot, relaxing parking requirements. All of that is so that we can fit more people into our neighborhoods, whether single family or multifamily or mixed. And when you do that, you save taxpayers money because you've already got those streets built. You've got the water lines there, the sewage, the police, and the fire. And you have more people living per square foot sharing that cost. So tax burden actually goes down for people.
And speaking of that whole infrastructure thing, and so this may be related to the next question, but does the city need to expand its actual boundaries and then build out more? And I guess they'd be taking in rural areas that are zoned, maybe even agricultural at this point. But
yeah, no, that would be a real big mistake. And there's some people who have this belief that if we just allowed more urban density out in the rural areas, that would solve our housing problem. The problem is it's super expensive for taxpayers because you have to maintain way more space. We're barely able to maintain the roads we have now within the city. But the second thing is it creates bigger problems. You have to build new schools that are expensive. You have worse traffic. And so, no, there's plenty of land in the city to build both single-family housing and multifamily if you relax the development regulations that are currently preventing that from happening. And council and the mayor have worked together to change that. Now the building community is going to adjust to that. And given all the people coming, they will, and they will build it, and people will buy it. There's just a little bit of a delay.
And then maybe related to that, and kind of again with the homeless issue, would there be an issue? I mean, any kind of concept of maybe having those tiny houses that we've seen experimented with in Olympia, for example, is that a viable option here?
It's a total viable option, you know, with some constraints to so that you don't destroy the character of a neighborhood. So there's really two kinds of options there. One is we allow, and we could allow more of what we call accessory dwelling units. And they're doing this in other cities where they just allow you to have a small freestanding cottage or smaller in your backyard.
Mm-hmm.
and you can rent it out. And some people are really arguing, Jim Frank, for instance, from Greenstone, you should be able to sell that little small college cottage. So that's one kind of thing. So you could go through neighborhoods all throughout the city and add more people living who are currently don't have enough money and are almost homeless. They would be in shelter. They would be part of the community, part of the fabric, instead of kind of exiles in their own city. And then the second thing you could do is a bigger kind of development. You could actually take a couple of housing lots and put a dozen of those. That's what they did in Olympia. I think they've got 40 of those very small houses with a bigger common area with laundry facilities and things like that there. That works well, too. Now, you don't want to have five of those 20 or 40 units right next to each other, but you can spread them out throughout the city. And again, when people feel that ownership of their own place, they tend to take care of it and become part of the community instead of dominating the community.
On today's Inland Journal podcast, we're talking with Brian Beggs, who's running for Spokane City Council President.
Now, this one's right up your alley. I mean, you worked on the Otto Zem case, so this is just general questions about police accountability. Maybe your satisfaction with the current system of public oversight in the ombudsman system. Issues with that, or how do you think that's going now?
Oh, I am far from satisfied. We've made great progress since I originally proposed the ombudsman's office. At this point, the complaints are half. Citizen complaints are half of what they were. Mm-hmm. And use of force by the police is half of what they were. That is remarkable for any community. And I say that I proposed the ombudsman and led that effort, but the work has been the entire community, including the police department and the leadership. They've done amazing things. We brokered disagreement with the Department of Justice for the police to bring in consultants and meet with the community and the department. And they came up with, I think, 42 different recommendations. And the police completed all of them. And the community trust in the police has gone from 55% to 85%. But there's still one pretty big gap, and it goes like this. The ombudsman is still not getting prompt access to all the complaints and all the materials. And the police department, for some reasons, maybe just natural defensiveness, has been a little reluctant to give full transparency to the ombudsman. So that's one problem. But the probably bigger problem is the ombudsman is not yet allowed to give his full independent opinion about what happened in any incident. He's only allowed to say whether he thought it was a thorough and fair and prompt investigation. But he doesn't get to tell you what he thinks actually happened on that night and what recommendations he has to make sure that that never happens again. That's in our city charter. He's supposed to be able to do that, but the union contract has not been updated to match the charter, and I'm working as hard as I can to get that to match. And although I get the defensiveness of the police about it, the fear they'll be judged unfairly, there's two things. One, the ombudsman report does not come out until after the discipline is completely over, all appeals are over, so it won't impact the discipline of an officer. But more importantly, when people have full faith that the ombudsman can speak his mind, almost all the time he endorses what the police did. But if you tell him he can't speak his mind and he doesn't get to endorse it, then people assume the police are hiding and the ombudsman disagrees with it. So it really is going to protect the majority of police officers in action if he can speak his mind, because there will be a few times he says, no, that was a problem and should be different. But the vast majority, he'll say, nope, they did exactly the right thing.
Okay. And then maybe just a quick read on the body cameras. How's that working out now?
Well, when they turn them on, it's working great. So the body cameras, and again, that was suggested by an earlier ombudsman. So that's the ombudsman process in practice. Tim Burns suggested that. And what police are finding and the studies show is that people are better behaved when they know they're on body cameras. Mm-hmm. And again, the body cameras, for the most part, show that police are doing the right thing. But the problem is the police are not always turning them on. And that's a problem. Now, sometimes it's just a short delay. You're getting out of your car and you didn't quiet. That's not really the issue. But when there's a full-blown incident going, as there was, I think, last January when someone was shot, there were reports of gunshots even before the police were there. And according to the prosecutor, several of the officers didn't turn on their body camera. Police leadership has told me that's a very serious policy violation, but I have not heard if they've disciplined anyone on that, and I have not really heard what they're doing to make sure that doesn't happen. That's showing up a little too often for comfort in some of these major events.
Let's move on to budget issues. So the mayor had his proposed 2020 budget, and obviously you're on the council now and reviewing that. So did you see priorities in there that you think are maybe going the wrong direction, or just overall read on the proposed budget?
Yeah, so I've been on the council's budget committee for the last 3 years, and it's a big thing to learn. It's, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. And so we've looked through it, but it's a little unclear what the mayor's priorities are at this point, because he's only given the overview of the personnel under the budget. He hasn't given the line items yet. We're a little delayed on getting that from the mayor. And when we get that, we'll really be able to weigh in. But I would think one of the, and this isn't the biggest thing in the world, but the mayor has a lot of people who are devoted to public relations and doing videos and PowerPoints and social media. Someone told me there's 17 people doing that kind of work. And the critique is that there's a lot of messaging and there could be more substance. So that's one area I'd like to see perhaps adjusted a little bit. And not to the detriment of any, you know, current workers. We have lots of vacant positions currently under this mayor because coming to the end of an 8-year term and they're not hiring replacements as people take new jobs. So I think you can do it without laying people off, but there are some priorities that way. I also think there's some sustainability priorities. We'll probably get into that later in terms of improving our tree canopy. That's probably the number one thing we can do for climate change in the city is more trees and better maintain trees. And then public safety, we really need to focus our police to the most effective policing and more community policing and more of these social worker police officer teams.
So that budget has about a $3.5 million, still a little $3.5 million over. And is part of the process now, are you guys looking at, in the council, looking at that and voicing your own opinion about what might need to be cut? And if so, what do you think is in there that might be over budget?
You know, the reason that it says it's over budget is that it's underestimating what our revenues are going to be and overestimating what the costs are. So this happens every year. It shows up like that about this time of year. And then we go through and then we really examine things and we figure it out. So we've, in the last few years, again, had a pretty rosy budget revenue picture. Our sales tax revenue, which is really the critical thing that changes, has gone up way higher than anyone has predicted each year. Now, that will come to an end at some point. We'll go into a recession, and we have to be ready to do that. But I don't think that there will actually be serious budget cutting for this budget, because once everything's adjusted and we get the actual line item, it'll be fine. Just to give you an example, we're at, I think, about what looks like going to be a $6 million net surplus this year off of what the budget was. And so we have that at a minimum that we can use for that $3 million. But I think we'll be able to fix that $3 million gap without even touching the $6 million that we have left over. What's challenging, though, is doing new things. And lots of people have lots of ideas what we should be doing more of. All great stuff. But that's where the prioritization. So it's not so much budget cutting in this revenue environment, but it will be some hard choices on prioritizing what most needs to be done new.
Well, one of the standby things that always gets asked, no matter what year or the campaign it is about the street, you know, repair and maintenance. And I know you've kind of touted that as being something that's really improved in the last couple of years. And maybe reiterate your thoughts on the amount of money that we're spending on that. I know there was a levy passed a while back.
Yeah. But. So the challenge, and I kind of alluded to this earlier, we just have too many streets to fix and keep. That's just kind of the deal. We just have too many. And so what the city has done in the last 15 years is we've tried to prioritize the streets. We've also tried to make sure that we're fixing the sewer pipes and the water pipes when we're fixing the streets. And what that means is if we're fixing primarily the sewer and water, we can use some of the sewer and water revenues to fix the streets. So we've done that. The voters have passed now two levies, I think one in 2005, and then we renewed it in 2012 or 2013. Since those levies have been going on now, so say 14 years, we have majorly repaired half the arterials in the city. So, and that's a huge amount of progress, and it just wasn't being done before. But half of the arterials still need to be replaced. So, and there's a particular, you know, there's some roads up north, Strong Road, that's just a, it's an old county road that we annex. It's just a disaster, and it's not on anyone's list to fix for the next 6 years. And anyone who lives there says, I can't even drive on it. But that's just the arterials. The real problem is the residential streets, which is the majority. We fix those with these car tabs, the $20 car tab that we all pay. And we only give, we get about $2 or $3 million a year. At that rate, we will not be able to get our residential streets fixed. So we're going to have to look at asking the voters for more. And then, as you know, Initiative 976, Tim Eymann's disaster, would go away. We wouldn't be able to fix any residential streets.
So you wouldn't
streets.
Even have that money at all.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That was my next question. I was just going to ask you about that, too.
Yeah. Okay. So I think, you know, we're doing better than we ever have. And I'm the chair of the Council's Public Works Committee, and I really enjoy working with the Streets Department, and I really applaud the progress. But if we really want to get to the next level of way more streets and even faster, we'll have to go to the voters and ask them if that's how they want to invest. And then, you know, not far behind that, we've got lots of sidewalks that are crumbling or street trees are buckling them. We've got 50 miles of unpaved streets that we're now, since I've been on council, we're starting to repair them slowly, like six blocks a year. So again, we'd have to do more. And then there's a bunch of alleys that need grading. So those are there. And then I guess the last thing I would say about streets that we're doing is we are, and again, credit to the street department, we're experimenting with new technologies, new types of pavement, new designs, new intermediate maintenance. We just tried this new thing on the South Hill where we took a very thin liquefied asphalt, we called it a slurry, and just put it over the street. And what it did on Bernard and Cali is it sealed up all the cracks so the water can't get in and freeze. So the cracks weren't deep, and we didn't need to repave. But we're hoping that that will give us another 5 years before we have to do a major repair there.
This special Inland Journal podcast features Steve Jackson talking with Brian Beggs, one of the candidates for Spokane City Council president.
I wanted to talk about the renewable energy goal for the city, but I wanted to lead into that with this very basic question that I've been asking every candidate is about climate change. Do you believe there is climate change, A, and B, do you think it's man-caused to some degree?
Yeah. Well, there is totally climate change. We just had snow in September. We had the windstorm. We've had the firestorm. We've had the ice storm. We've had flooding. The river is raging wild earlier in the season and then running out of water at the late part of the season. So I don't think really anyone's denying that the climate is changing here and in the world if you look at hurricanes and typhoons. I totally believe it's human influenced, just all the data, all the science. I mean, I don't think there's really any question about that. But as a city, people are like, well, what can you do as a city? Well, there's two levels. One, there's our share of reducing our carbon and greenhouse gas footprint that we're working on citywide. The mayor's office is too. So we all are, where there's not really a disagreement between council and the mayor on that. And then secondly, regardless of what you think about human causes, the climate is changing and we have to adapt and become more resilient. So we have to change our water uses to deal with the fact that the river's so low in the summer. We have to figure out what to do with all the smoke during wildfire season and how to protect even the city. We have hundreds of fires in the city limits, wildfires every year. Luckily, none of them have gotten too big or out of control, but you could see California-style disasters of fires going through neighborhoods if we're not pruning the underbrush and getting our fire plans set, so that we're really focusing on all these resiliency strategies to adapt to the very certain climate changes.
So in other words, it's not too big of an issue to be debated in city government to talk about these kind of specific maybe answers to questions that we don't even know what's coming up next.
No. And you know, actually, if the world is going to survive, well, the world will survive fine. If humanity is going to survive climate change, it will take every city and village and county and state and nation figuring out their own solutions and doing their part, both in terms of reducing climate change and also adapting to the climate changes that are coming. I mean, if we fixed it tomorrow, we still have all these hurricanes and tornadoes and weather chaos. So we have to adapt to that. They're very expensive, but there are things that we know we can do to make it less expensive and to basically save people's lives.
Let's talk just a bit then about this renewable energy goal for the city. And maybe, and this might help me on the other story too, if you just gave me a little bit of background. In other words, the council proposed this renewable energy goal, but then it got modified, and then Avista jumped on it and supported it more than the initial proposal. Is that correct?
Well, somewhat. So the deal, when people are strategizing big picture on how to transform our economy into a carbon neutral economy, is the number one thing is move as much of your energy use as possible to electricity. So right now we use a lot of fossil fuel to do transportation and natural gas to heat buildings. Those two things are probably the biggest emitters of carbon and greenhouse gases. If you move it to electricity, which you can then make renewable and not a carbon footprint, you can really change things up. So Avista for a while has been focusing on how do we electrify transportation and how do we electrify heating. And so I led an effort with Avista and sat down with them and said, hey, Avista, you supply us the electricity for the whole – when I say the city, I don't mean the city government. The city government actually generates enough electricity to energize its operations as a city government. But in terms of the actual population and business of the city, Avista provides it. And so we went to them and said – hey, we think we need to get to 100% renewable electricity by 2030. You provide it.
For everybody in the city.
Everyone in the city, really. And really beyond the city, because if Avista's doing it for the city limits, they'll be doing it for most of the county as well.
Sure.
I think Inland Power has a small piece of the county. But so we went to them and they said, yeah, that's good. We're all about that. We're in the electricity business. We would love everybody to use electricity instead of fossil fuels. But here's the challenge. What happens, you know, on a no wind night in the dead of winter? How do we provide enough electricity? Because the batteries we have right now aren't quite good enough to do it. And so they said, will you make sure that there's not a legal penalty if we don't have exactly 100% on January 1st, 2030? And we said, sure. And my view of it, I mean, some hardcore climate change people were like, nope, we got to hold the line. And I'm like, if we're at 99.9% on December 31st, 2029, I think we're good.
So in other words, and is this correct? Then they called it an aspirational goal. Would you say that's what the city signed on to?
We use different language than that. Our goal is 100%, and that's what the law is. But the difference is that if on a particular day or a particular time, if they're not 100%, they're 99.99 or something like that, there's not a legal consequence to them. That's the relief they wanted. Now, what they told me is that they think we'll get there. Not really a problem. And in fact, they've announced to the world they are going to get there. But they just don't know for sure because we don't have the technology to get there. We have this great catalyst building project where they are literally experimenting in the most energy efficient, it's an energy zero building in the nation by the University District Bridge. And they've got a battery system so that as they collect the solar during the day, it can go in the battery and light and heat the building during the night. They're doing that science right now with the city and WSU. So I have no doubt that by 2030, those problems will be there. But they wanted the assurance that they would not have a financial or legal penalty. And so we agreed to that. We said, if that's all you need to commit yourself 100% towards this, that's a no-brainer. And to my knowledge, no other community had negotiated that with a private utility other than Spokane. While we were having that negotiation, the mayor's office was against our ordinance and against our sustainability committee. And they asked Avista, they said, Avista, using existing technology today, how much would it cost to go to 100% at 2030? And Avista gave them some data, and it was going to be really expensive because it was that assumption, existing technology. And the Avista people told me, hey, by 2030, none of that applies. And so it should not be any more expensive. And in fact, what the trends are right now in Colorado, they put out an RFP for energy, electricity, and the renewable energy, wind and solar, was cheaper than the fossil fuel. And that's right. That was actually last year. So that is now with existing technology. So you can imagine 10 years from now, as we continue to accelerate that technology, it won't just be achievable, it will be cheaper.
And I guess the final follow-up would be from a totally different candidate saying that they were under the impression that it's going to cost, quote, thousands of dollars for individual households down the road over that 10-year period.
And that is just not true at all. And that's just something that the mayor repeated at the time. And again, they were using old data to say that. They weren't using where we're going and what the trends are going to be. And so that's not. And there's nothing in our law that we passed that is going to require consumers to pay more for electricity because it is 100% renewable. Nothing in that law. It'll be just the opposite. It should be cheaper. Our environment will be cleaner. The whole economy will be better with better jobs. And I am proud that Spokane passed that before the state, because when Spokane is leading on issues like energy and the economy, the rest of the state follows, because Spokane is considered kind of middle America in Washington. And if it plays in Spokane, it will play in Seattle. And I am just tired of sticking my head in the sand as a city and saying, we're just going to wait for Seattle and Olympia to tell us what to do. We need to do it here in Spokane with Spokane values, and then we can influence the legislature to pass the laws that we like.
I think I might just end with this. Your opponent has said, and some others have said, that the city council in the last iteration of it has gone kind of out of its way to do things that maybe aren't that important to the average citizens, and getting involved in, I guess, environmental issues are going afield from what their real job should be. Maybe just quick wrap up. Can you address that?
You know, I've heard some people say that our city council sometimes is driving outside of its lane. That's really just an excuse to say they like things just the way they are, and the people that support them like things just the way they are. All the initiatives that we've worked on, whether improving the workforce, improving race relations, the environment, immigration, housing density, dealing with the homeless, all those issues we have started because our constituents demand that we solve problems in Spokane that both the state and the federal government have either refused or been unable to do. And every time we handle a big problem at a local level, we scale it for Spokane, we lead for the state, we lead for the nation, we even lead for the world on some of these issues. But the beauty of it is that we use Spokane values and Spokane constituents' views to inform these very local solutions.
Brian Beggs is running for Spokane City Council President. His opponent is Cindy Wendell, from whom we'll hear tomorrow. You can hear the interviews with candidates for Spokane and Spokane Valley city offices at the Spokane Public Radio website. Click on the Regional News tab and then on Election 2019, or go to the Inland Journal page. Or you can listen to them by subscribing to the Inland Journal podcast in Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or Google Play. Thanks for joining us. I'm Doug Nadvornik.